Welcome to Season 4 of The Farcast, bringing you experts and insiders every week to help you navigate the economic and investing landscape. And now, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to The Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week here on Can You Believe It? May the 6th. May the 6th, here we go. Markets have been holding in, actually doing pretty well. And looking back year to date, we are now through the busiest part of earnings season, and they have been coming in hot for the S&P 500. Stocks have been driving higher. The bond market actually has been driving higher. That means that the yields have been going lower. Gold drifting a bit higher. Oil is a lot higher this morning. So all you need to do is own something. And apparently you're going to make money because it's going higher. Looking back a bit further, the tech sector kind of peaked in terms of its momentum almost a year ago, May of 2020. And yet, even though the Mo peaked, it's still doing pretty well. Year to date, Russell 1000 value up 16%. Russell 1000 growth up 5%. Now, you're still making money, but boy, wouldn't you like to have a little more fun and whatever it is that happens to be up 16%. To make sense of all of this, of course, we go to our great friend Jim Labenthal from Cerity Partners, a contributor on CNBC Halftime Report. You see him all the time. We always advise everyone we know, when you see Jim, listen to Labenthal. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you, Michael. And of course, I will now routinely give you the adage to follow Farr.
Follow Farr. There we go. Jim, we've heard some doom and gloom reports. We've heard B of A about 30 days ago suggesting the market, the S&P, would close down from where we are today. It's moved up since then. What do you make of all of this? Are you encouraged by stocks, or are you worried by Janet Yellen last week?
Not worried about Janet Yellen. Let me check that box first. I'm not worried about that much, Michael. I think there's an awful lot of hand-wringing going on in the market right now. And a lot of it centers on technology stocks, which, as you brought up, have at best languished over the past few months. And when you look at some of the high-flying, growthier areas like software or cloud, those stocks are down meaningfully. But I think what you've got going on here is a narrow sector, namely those high flyers, are coming down to earth. And if you look at, for instance, a Zoom or a Shopify, something like that, if you look at their one-year charts, you would say these are pretty fabulous returns. So why are we sweating a 4 month or a 6 month return? But to put sort of a bow on what I'm trying to say, we're in the second year of a recovery here. The first year was gangbusters, right? Last year was incredible. What COVID pandemic? The second year, traditionally in a recovery, is a little bit harder to get the gains. We're going to get those gains, but it's going to be choppy. It's going to be volatile, and it's going to feel like it was painful. But in reality, it's going to be normal. Let me put it into perspective with Apple. Last 5 years, compound annual growth rate, 42% in the share price. Well, what if you get 15% growth this year in Apple? And right now it's flat. That's going to feel like a very disappointing year. But actually, it's a remarkable year if they do that. It's just that in the perspective of the last 5 years, it's going to feel painful.
Yeah. Are you changing your portfolio, Jim, as we move into this period of inflation? We have seen clearly that the value stocks have begun to outperform. I mean, they've been outperforming for quite a while now, but we had that sort of blip back, right? I mean, we had a blip back in April where it looked like, you know, some of the tech stocks and some of the growth was doing better. That seemed to be episodic. That seemed to be a little bit of a trading blip. What are you looking for, and are you changing anything?
Well, you know that I've always been a value guy, and that term has a pejorative sense to it over the last 5 years. I don't think it should. I think what it really means is that you're paying attention to the price that you pay for shares, that you're not just buying for whatever level of growth at whatever price you can get it. What I have done in the past few months is add to some of my growth at a reasonable price names. So I have added a little bit to Apple, to Qualcomm, to Microsoft. They're still languishing, frankly. They had great technology earnings reports last week, but the share prices languished. I don't think that's the wrong thing to do. You alluded to April. It was a good month. I think these stocks, apropos of what I said a minute ago, if Apple has a 15% return this year, I'm going to be absolutely fine with it, just like I'm fine with the financials, which are going to continue to rally as interest rates go up, or energy, which, you know, was left for dead 9 months ago. Frankly, it's the best sector this year. I think that's going to continue. And dare I mention industrials, Michael, that's a sector you and I love because we know what industrials do. We can think about what the growth drivers are, and they trade at good prices, at good value prices with good dividend yields. What you don't hear me saying is that I'm buying the Twilios of the world or the Rokus of the world.
I've never heard you say that. I've never heard you buy those stocks. I can't imagine you buying those stocks ever. I don't care what the environment is. What would it take for you to buy one of those kind of companies?
First off, I think longtime listeners and watchers of the show will note that I have had my dalliances with Roku over the years.
Oh, well, sorry, Michael. You know, youth is not entirely wasted on the young, but we learn those lessons at a price, don't we? The price of a dalliance.
You've blocked out these memories because they besmirch my otherwise pure as the undriven snow reputation.
That could be the title of today's show, you know, the price of a dalliance on Wall Street. The price of a dalliance on Wall Street, that could be the title of our next book there, Leventhal, we could write together.
But I'll tell you something, Michael, there is a price. There is a price for every stock. So when I talk about Roku, when I talk about Twilio, when I talk about, don't block your ears, Tesla, there is a price.
God.
Okay? There is a price. It's pretty darn far below where we are now.
Yes.
But if you take, I'll take Roku because I have had those dalliances in the past. What has traditionally just been a momentum stock, actually, the business has been growing mightily. No surprise there. It's been growing mightily. And the price has come down from about 480 to 300 today. You're entering a level where you might actually be able to value this. You might actually be able, and they're going to report earnings tonight, you might actually be able to look at next year's earnings and say, there are earnings. And you might be able to actually attach a price to that. Now, I'm not going to attach a triple digit multiple to those earnings. But let's just see where they come out. Let's see where the price goes. I guess what I'm saying is, while these high-flying growth stocks have been no touch for the past several months, they do keep coming down, and there is a price at which they could be attractive.
The one thing you and I have always agreed on are that balance sheets, strong balance sheets, are your seat during the game of musical chairs. When the music stops, those with a chair of a strong balance sheet have a seat. Those with the Rokus do not. So there's got to be some there in a company that people just completely discount when markets are soaring. But when markets actually pull back, and ladies and gentlemen, I promise they pull back, and we're going to have a pullback. We're going to have a good pullback. It's going to hurt. Don't ask me exactly when, but I assure you it's coming. It always comes. And the Johnson & Johnsons of the world will go down, but there is a real company underneath. Some of these startups, some of these concept stocks will go out of business. It happens every cycle. So yeah, you can get a big bang for your buck with some of these concept high-flying, who knows what they do tomorrow stocks, but you can also get burned. So Jim Leventhal and I have been burned a lot. Jim, haven't we?
Well, we have. And you know, so have managements of companies. Now, I was listening to you just now, and I've got to make an observation. This is an empirical observation. You do with it what you will, but this is something I've found over the last 2 weeks. Talking to company managements of cyclical companies, they are now generating tons of cash. I'm talking energy, I'm talking steel companies. And you know what they're doing with it, Michael? They are paying down debt. They're not buying shares. They're not increasing dividends, not much anyway. They're paying down debt. And I spoke to one CEO of an iron ore steel manufacturer. This is Cleveland Cliffs, Lorenzo Gonzalez. He made it clear that he might actually pay down all his debt. And I thought at first I was taken aback. I said, well, wait a second. Shouldn't you give some of that shareholder capital back to the shareholders? He said, and this is now a common refrain, He said, who saw COVID-19 coming? And if we had had to refinance our debt in April of last year, we wouldn't have been able to. I do not want my company at risk of that happening. I've seen similar moves at Kinder Morgan. I've seen similar moves at General Motors just reported yesterday. Fabulous free cash flow. Fabulous. They didn't reinstate the dividend. Companies are paying down debt because they know anything can happen. And your point is well made. And managements completely agree with you, Michael. Fortress-like balance sheets will get you through your lifespan and not have to worry about a pandemic or an asteroid or whatever the black swan event may be that comes up next.
Right. You don't, in those moments, you don't care about whether you're overperforming or underperforming by 60 basis points. You care whether you're going to have your money left whenever what the hell is going on comes through and finishes. Jim, I can't believe it. Out of time. It is fabulous to talk to you. Give Fred and Ethel some advice here between now and the end of the year, because they've been told, Jim Labenthal, that they're supposed to buy low and sell high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average made a new high yesterday. Some people have a lot of cash. What do they do with it? And what should Fred and Ethel be thinking now as the market's making all-time highs?
You've got a very stimulative fiscal picture, very. You've got a very accommodative Fed, very. That shows no sign of stopping. You've got vaccines continuing to roll out. I'm aware of the variants, but the economy's reopening. This is a pretty good time to be invested. If you've already bought low, it's not a time to sell high, it's a time to hold. If you haven't bought low, you can buy right now and you can feel good about the next 18 months you're going to make money. Maybe choppy, but hang in there. This is not a time to sell.
The waves are still rolling in. Don't put your surfboard away yet, says Jim Labenthal from Cerity Partners, CNBC contributor, particularly on the halftime report, and my good friend. Thank you so much, Jim. We really appreciate it.
Always my pleasure. Go far by following far.
Listen to Labenthal. And when we come back, we get to listen to the great Dan Mahaffey, our senior political analyst, on the Farcast. Please stay with us.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. Welcome back to the Farcast. And now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. What a terrific segment with Jim Labenthal. I always learn so much. And he brought up some really interesting points about what's going on with companies' balance sheets, the paying down of debt, so that they need a strong balance sheet to get through difficult times. They learned, a lot of these companies, about their vulnerabilities. And it's making me think about the things that perhaps the U.S. learned or maybe didn't learn about the vulnerabilities of our economy, which takes us, of course, to our great friend Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress and the senior political analyst on the Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Michael. You know, we're going to Washington around the world, and it's muddle through with Mahaffey.
Muddle through with Mahaffey. Hardly. We do follow, of course, Wall Street, Washington, and the world, and we're going to do a little Washington and world with you here. What did we learn here, Dan, about the supply chain issues we had with COVID and with automobile parts and all of the things that we import from China and Asia and around the world, and even what we're going through now with semiconductor chips and a just-in-time supply chain? You know, one of the things that Dell Computer really did that was amazing, most computer manufacturers, real hardware manufacturers, went during the 90s when these computer things were new, had huge warehouses where they would stock all of the parts necessary to assemble these computers. Dell stopped doing that. Dell said, we're going to use FedEx, and we're going to order these parts as we need them, and we'll have them here the next day, and we don't have to pay for all of that inventory, and we'll just run open orders. And it transformed really modern manufacturing and got rid of a whole lot of warehouses. So, but here there's a vulnerability, wasn't there? When those shipments don't come in, you can't just go to your warehouse and get the next motherboard to snap in.
Right. When your supply chain becomes a finely engineered Swiss watch, it doesn't do so well when you fall into the pool. And the fact of this is that the COVID exposed to tons of stresses. And what we're seeing now in semiconductors, and this is interesting, our organization, CSPC, we did a session on this yesterday. Listeners can see it on our YouTube channel, CSPC DC. The discussion—
Wait, do one more time. CSPC DC?
CSPC DC is our YouTube channel. What we've discovered is that there were obviously geopolitical challenges. You had shutdowns at certain fabs that mainly are overseas as COVID worsened, our reliance on China. Some industries like the automotive industry, they zigged when they should have zagged. They actually canceled semiconductor orders. China stockpiled semiconductors because the Trump administration was telegraphing various trade restrictions long in advance. And really, this was a perfect storm that revealed the vulnerability of this supply chain, and particularly just-in-time manufacturing. And so as we look at these lessons from COVID, and I think as Jim Labenthal was talking about, and you were talking about looking at balance sheets, now looking at supply chains is important for companies. And Washington is going to be increasingly doing that in these strategic sectors of semiconductors, batteries, rare earths, and pharmaceuticals.
Do we have the wherewithal to actually do all that? Because this is different from protectionism. This is different from saying, you know, we're going to make everything here and source everything here and the hell with the world. Because economists would say, no, you go to your most efficient market, you go to your cheapest price producer in order to source your parts and goods and supplies. This is a little bit different. We found that there's another risk. And how do we assess that, the cost of that risk? How do we say it's worth it now to have this much of this production in the U.S., even if it's at a higher cost, in order to protect that supply chain?
Well, and I think that's where you're going to start to have an industrial policy increasingly come into play, which has been a dirty word in Washington since the Reagan Revolution, but is coming back. The idea of, in certain sectors, what might be a minimum strategic capacity or minimum resilient capacity to ensure that the United States had semiconductors or certain things during a crisis. And then finally, an emphasis on government for supporting, because what we're seeing in this current semiconductor shortage is we forget it's the low end chips that, you know, it's the, you know, we focus on securing the high end stuff from being stolen by China, but we're also reliant on them for the cheap commoditized, you know, little crap chips, but 2,500 chips that still go into a car, or the 900 in a phone, all of that is overseas. And so how can government say, look, this is, and it might not even be here in the US, it might be near shoring or looking at other countries, Malaysia, Vietnam, expanding into Central America for semiconductor or production of this. But how do you reduce that strategic reliance on China? And also, you know, where does this fit into our discussions on Taiwan? Because that gets into military deterrence, diplomacy, and crises there.
Is this a role for government? I mean, it sort of sounds like deciding on these minimum safe areas is more a role for government. Left up to industry, industry's going to just go to the most profitable area, which is what we sort of want them to do. But government, it sounds like this may be a role for government. As much as I hate to say that government has a role in anything, I think they actually do.
They will. And this is, and you know, we're going to have to consider the ramifications of this in terms of what kind of floor this might create in the marketplace, or how does this capacity sit in reserve if we're actually building manufacturing capacity that may sit idle until there's time of a crisis. There's a lot of outstanding questions about this that I think need to be resolved, but we're seeing billions of dollars in these proposals coming from Congress on semiconductors, other strategic industries. So keep an eye on that.
While we are talking about the supply chain around the world, give us just a minute on the temperature of our current relationship with China. And then I want to talk about why it seems we're lifting the veil of the formula on the vaccine for India. But talk about China first, because we're going back to the supply chain issue. We've got Jim Labenthal certainly talked about the benefits of the opening economy from the those who've been vaccinated. I'm in a hotel right now in New Orleans at a conference and flew, and I've been vaccinated, and I still didn't feel very comfortable, and it wasn't a great, pleasant experience, but the world is reopening. Right. So, Dan, touch on where we are with China first, and then perhaps move to what's going on with the vaccine and Pfizer.
I think where we are with China is the beginning of a period of very tough competition. We're looking at their military buildup. They're building ships like we haven't seen countries build ships like that since World War II. Their naval capacity, their ability to force reunification with Taiwan, if that ever happened. We're getting closer to that. Look, I don't think the Chinese are suicidal in the sense of forcing a war, but the risk of confrontation is growing. And they've also focused a lot more on financial influence, legal influence, media influence, ways where they think they can get around US military power. But look, I think the relationship there is getting tenser, and therefore we need to be more concerned about our supply chains and the risk of miscalculation in that region. I think we've been consistent on that theme. Where I think that connects, as you point out, to the vaccine question and IP, I see this in the administration. Some of the logic is with the situation in India, that dire crisis we're seeing right there, the need to get the vaccination out in the developing world. Within the lens of that competition with China, the United States needs to be a lead player in vaccinating the rest of the world and showing that it's that perhaps big pharma, in the sense, look, the Marshall Plan was not great for Ford because it made Volkswagen viable again, but it was necessary for the geostrategic interests of the time and to keep the developing world and India in a pro-US block. And I think, look, it forces the Europeans' hand on this too. Japan and others will come along, I think, but it's necessary in terms of this geostrategic competition, even if it doesn't make the most sense in terms of a business interest.
Is China the new evil empire?
I think the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping are the embodiment of a system that could not be more anathema to us, a genocide. I think we have to avoid the idea that this is a civilizational struggle with China, but rather one with a leadership that has a truly techno-authoritarian vision for how a society and an economy should be managed.
Dan, in 1990, I think it was 1990, I was a part of a group that went to the Soviet Union. I still was in the Soviet Union. I went to Leningrad before it became St. Petersburg. I met with all sorts of government officials. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I was a young man at the time. And I taught stock markets. I taught capitalism to help the Soviets and Russians open their stock markets. It was a fascinating process during that period between Bush and Gorbachev and that new thawing of relationships with the Soviet Union. And as you might imagine, when I was there, I was welcomed with wonderful warmth and opened arms and invited into homes and given home cooked meals, and it was really one of those moments where people got to relate with each other, to each other as people. And as for, because I grew up, you know, in the 60s, they would have air raids, and they would have us under our desks in case the nuclear bomb hit, and all of those things that would have been so entirely useless. When I landed in Moscow for the first time in my life, and I couldn't believe I was there, there was the biggest hammer and sickle red flag that I have ever seen in my life. This was the largest flag. This thing was the size of a football field on top of that airport terminal in Moscow, waving back and forth, casting a shadow fabulously over our airplane. and it would get dark and it would get light and it would get dark and it would get light. And I thought, this is such a fabulous metaphor for how I'm feeling at the moment and where we were in terms of our relationships. So I think it's important to remember that the Chinese people themselves are not evil people. And we hope that they will remember that the American people are not evil people. But when we begin to force our worldview on another society and culture, we clash, and we clash at all points during history, right? So,
and the thing is too, and we have to, in focusing on things like semiconductors and R&D and where this competition is going to be, look, we to have these things where it's a suspicion of Chinese students and researchers coming to the US, you know, for God's sake, balance that. Like, I give them the FBI background check, but then also a $150,000 grant to stay in the United States and do research work. Like, balance out the security understanding of the threat with also that the United States wins by being the open, dynamic, driven country.
The violence that we're seeing against Asian Americans over the coronavirus or the implied guilt or responsibility, ladies and gentlemen, I know that this is none of our listeners, but dear God, that sort of stupidity has to stop. It just has to stop. So, Dan, we're already over the time because I just gave my speech on the Soviet Union, and I apologize, Harry, because I've just screwed up his time in editing. Please talk to me very quickly about Liz Cheney, why the Republican Party is getting ready to get her out of leadership. How has President Trump controlled so much still of the Republican Party? 80% of the GOP of the Republicans still support Donald Trump. Mitch McConnell said yesterday that 100% of my focus is on stopping the Biden administration from turning America into a socialist country. It sounded a lot like Trump.
Well, look, the Liz Cheney situation.
Do it in a minute, Dan. I got a minute.
Liz Cheney situation here. It's the end of the beginning in the post January 6th story of the Republican Party. President Trump, Fox News, there's their narrative of January 6th. That is now the message in the Republican Party, even if a lot of the rank and file just want to quietly move on to it and on to the Biden administration.
What has Ms. Cheney said about the pressures on her?
Well, Liz Cheney has said that Congresswoman Cheney has said, look, she's standing up for the Constitution. She's standing up for the rule of law. It's a matter of principle. And what happened on January 6th should never happen by another president. And that's just not a message the rest of the GOP can get behind.
That sounds a bit disturbing to me, that's not a message. I watched that on television. I presume a lot of Americans watched that assault on the Capitol building where they were hustling to get the vice president of the United States to a safe place in the United States Capitol building, for God's sakes. Maybe one of the lowest points in American history. And I guess I just don't understand the let's just move on sort of a moment. Let's just move on. Well, I'm not sure how we do it, but I would have said that. I would have said, no, we can't just move on. My intuition is you don't move on from something like that. And once again, I feel naive and I'm shocked because it certainly appears that we're moving on. We'll see if we're able to move on at the midterm elections. We'll see if it is no longer in the history books in a few years because it'll probably offend someone, which I'm also against, by the way. That you can't teach Huckleberry Finn in a public school right now, I think is one of the most horrible things I've ever heard. I taught Huckleberry Finn. It is one of the greatest pieces of literature and actually probably the beginning of the civil rights movement, and I can explain that on another literary forecast. I won't do it now, but hugely, hugely important, and you can't teach it anymore. When you can't teach stuff, we start going down bad roads. We're gonna go down a very good road with Stephanie Link when we come back. Please stay with us. Thank you, Dan Mahaffey, you're the best.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining us now, my great friend, the great Stephanie Link from Hightower Advisors. She is the chief equity strategist. You see her on CNBC and you see her on social media. And I am telling you, you want to follow the link, everybody. Follow the link. You want to get smart. You want to learn a lot. Listen to my friend Stephanie. Stephanie, welcome back to the Farcast.
It's great to be here, Michael. You're so kind.
You are wonderful to do this. Stephanie, markets, the Dow Jones Industrial Average made a new high yesterday. Russell 1000 growth up 16, value is up 16%. Russell 1000 value up 16% year to date. Russell 1000 growth up 5%. The rotation continues. It looked like maybe April, we saw the tech stocks and the growth kind of come back a bit. Maybe that was just a little short-term, you know, ratchet back the other way as we see watch markets always go through some sort of a sawtooth pattern. You think the value trade is still here to stay? When markets are trading at a new high, should Fred and Ethel still be buying? Is there more room left to go? Tell us what you think.
Well, I know you and I think very similarly. It's all about diversification, right? You do definitely want to have a barbell approach. And I truly believe that because at any given time, like you said, April, after the first quarter of value outperforming growth, then in the beginning of April, we saw a complete reversal the first 3 weeks and then changed back to value. So you do want to have certainly exposure to value because it's lagged over the last 10 years. To growth, number one, and you are going to have some mean reversion, but B, more importantly, value tends to outperform growth when the economy is growing faster, when there's a little bit more inflation, and when there's higher interest rates. Now, we don't have higher interest rates, but we know the Fed is kind of, they're kind of mixing it up a little bit, and maybe it's not as traditionally, it's not responding like it usually would, the bond market being, meaning. But I do think the other pieces of the economy, we are certainly seeing recover. We just did 6.4% GDP growth. We're probably going to do double that in the second quarter.
And you really think we're going to get to 12% in the second quarter?
I think we could, for sure. I mean, think about this. Personal consumption up 10.2%. That was the second best since the 1960s. Personal income, 21.1%. And that's, in my lifetime, I don't know about you, but I have never seen that kind of a number. And we know it's fiscal related. We know that, you know, that the government is certainly subsidizing the consumer, but it still means that the savings rate is 27%. Historically, it's 5%. And so if you were to just get back to that, you kind of, again, mean revert, you're at $3 trillion of pent-up potential spend in the consumer. And then if you look at manufacturing, all the ISMs, all the PMIs, all the regional series are actually doing quite well. They're well above 50, which is expansion, right? And so you have two big parts of the economy, consumer, which is 70% of the economy, and we have manufacturing, which is 10%, doing really, really well. So yeah, I mean, there's a shot. There's a shot we could almost do a double. And then for the full year, probably more like 7-8%, because we are going to come down from these really aggressive numbers. But even that being said, we are seeing pockets of inflation in commodities. And if we continue to see improvement in jobs, which we just got another good initial claims number today, you know, you could easily see unit labor costs starting to rise. And that's the big tell on inflation is wages. And right now their unit labor costs are zero. That's the good news. The bad news is that they're zero because they probably only have one way to go, and that's higher.
So we were talking about labor and the unemployment rate, and I said that actually in discussing with Labenthal that when you look at the hiring demands right now and you're seeing signing bonuses in some very strange industries that typically don't see signing bonuses, there is a demand for employees that will be met with money. Now, I was also talking on the Farcast last week a little bit with Jack Barugian, who sort of describe some structural tapping of the brakes that are already in place in the economy, that loans that have been basically frozen with the banks and there's some sort of a workout, we're coming to the end of that period where the loans that have been sort of in forbearance will no longer be in forbearance. And when a loan comes out of forbearance, of course, either the lender loses money or the borrower loses. Somebody's going to lose on that trade somewhere when you come out of forbearance. The eviction moratorium is over. And maybe these unemployment benefits that have led to this stronger consumer are also going to be over. And with those things coming off, will there be enough brakes, tapping on the brakes? Will it just be enough of a little bit of a slowdown that perhaps the Federal Reserve can sit on its hands for a while? I think it's a very interesting sort of a notion that there are these structural slowdowns in place. What do you think about Barugian's idea there?
I understand where he's coming from, and I respect him very much. I do believe that the stimulus, though, that has been put in place is so powerful in general. You know, we've had 60%. If you add up fiscal and monetary policies together, collectively, it's 60% of U.S. GDP. We haven't even used $3 trillion that we've just recently passed. That's right. Number one. And then number two, you have an infrastructure bill coming. I don't know what the size is going to be, Michael. It's probably $1 to $2 trillion. And then there's more behind it should they need. And the whole reason why I focus on infrastructure, and I know that our government is focusing on infrastructure, is because for every one job created in manufacturing, 7.7 jobs are created around it. And so if one way to really see an improvement in the job market is that, right? And so I get that, and not to mention the fact that we need it, you know, and roads and bridges and everything else are just really, you know, collapsing all over the country. But I would say that, so if there is a pullback in some of the other areas, like you mentioned, in loans and that sort of thing, in the eviction moratorium, I think there's other parts of the fiscal and monetary that will stay very, very accommodative. Now, right. I have to tell you, I think that the Fed, they said they're going to let inflation run hot. We haven't seen really big inflation yet. Just wait, though, because we start to get really easy comparisons. So the headline number is not going to look so great coming up in the next couple of months. I think that I'm really focused on, you know, obviously they're focused on employment, but also inflation. I worry about the inflation impact and all of the stimulus and what it means. And so I don't know if they can sit on their hands or not. I don't think we need them this much fiscal, and I don't know if we need to have this much in terms of what the monetary policies are doing right now. So that's my.
I don't think we do at all. I don't think we need as much as we're going to get at all. I'm not sure that we've needed as much as we've gotten.
Yes.
But you know, one of the things that Abby Joseph Cohen, and that's a name from the past, I know for a lot of our listeners from Goldman Sachs, who's absolutely brilliant. Strategist from Goldman Sachs, during the late 1990s would talk about clean earnings. And what she was talking about was clean earnings in a low inflation environment. And the idea here is that if you are a manufacturer and you are a manufacturer of stainless steel tubing and pipe, you have inventory. You've got a bunch of stainless steel sitting in a yard or warehouse somewhere. And during your manufacturing and order process, the value in an inflationary environment of the stuff sitting in your warehouse starts to increase. And you can pass those prices along. So just from the stuff sitting in your warehouse to the time you actually get finished product out, stainless steel prices go up 10%. You can mark your final product up 10%. You didn't have to pay 10% more for your stainless steel raw materials. Therefore, your profits look like they're 10% higher. Abby Joseph Cohen said, Wall Street's not stupid. We know you didn't add value there. You just benefited off of smart. And you're going to have higher costs going forward. Those margins are going away unless inflation's really on a roll and it's a rolling thing. So when we look at earnings coming ahead, Stephanie, you and I at some point are going to have to talk with our analysts and say, give me that adjusted non-inflation number to look at. And then how are we going to see that, Stephanie, as something that's episodic that the Fed said is going to go away? I don't really know how to invest like that. I've never had to do it before.
It's a challenge for sure. But I think in the next, let's just say, we're going to have to worry about that probably in the next year, I would say.
Yeah.
But in the next 3 to 6 months, and I know you and I are much longer term than even a year. But in the next 3 or 6 months, I think, you know, we talked about rotation the last time I was on. And you and I have talked about it endlessly on TV together. I think the reason that you are seeing this rotation, not only because growth is better, inflation is creeping higher and that sort of thing, but it also is because these industrial companies, these material mining companies, they do have prices.
Yes.
Right. And so,
yes.
So they've kept their margins very, very strong because they've restructured for the last year. That's, they had to, they had no choice because demand just disappeared. So now when you have margins that are strong and you actually have top line revenue sales that are going
yes.
higher, you have operating leverage. And I will just point out to a company called Caterpillar, and they had massive operating leverage this past quarter, but they didn't even take price yet. They're taking
yes.
price this summer. So can you just even imagine how much more you're gonna, how much more operating leverage you're going to see? Dow Chemical had 19% price increases year over year, 14% sequentially. So there's, it's happening, to your point. But you know what? If earnings are going higher, stocks usually follow earnings. And,
yep.
and that's what's important, at least in the near term. Yes, but we're going to have to deal with this, with what you were talking about and what Abby Joseph Cohen was talking about, for certain.
It's coming up. It's going to be some new calculus that we're going to have to add and think about. So to your point, we continue to have fiscal stimulus. We continue to have monetary stimulus. We still have a recovery from the vaccine. We have pent up demand from consumers who are enthusiastic about buying, and they have the cash with which to buy. That is a dreamy environment for investors and for economists right now. I don't know about the price to pay with all of this debt down the road. Nobody else seems to give a damn. What I do care about, though, Stephanie, is when you, we seem to be in one of those periods where you buy, you're buying high. There's no way. Well, the market's making new highs. If you're going to buy today, you're buying high. And you have Labenthal and Link and Farr all saying it's going higher. We all feel it's going higher. So buy high and maybe sell higher doesn't seem like our traditional advice. So what should Fred and Ethel do?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Though you and I, and probably Jim, were buying back in last March, April, May, I went much more cyclical in last summer. So it is hard to buy. But here's the thing. Earnings season always gives us chances, right? Because you have these, I call it silly season, because a company can blow it away, they can
yep.
raise guidance, and
yep.
then the stock is down. And it's all about expectations because the stock has run, right? I understand that completely. But I think you do get opportunities. I had a company yesterday, Corteva, that fell 6%. They beat, but they didn't raise, and people got a little agita over it. And I think those are the kinds of opportunities you see, and that's the kind of thing you want to do when we're at this point. Because yes, you're right, all the stocks are high. I would argue that industrials, materials, and even financials,
yes.
they are still bargains out there. Remember, you buy
yes.
you buy cyclicals, you buy industrials and materials when they look expensive, because
yes.
their earnings are troughing, right? And as
that's
the economy
right.
improves, that's when you don't ever buy a cyclical company when it's cheap. You really don't, other than the banks.
With a low, you may, so if you look at a low price to earnings multiple on an oil stock, that is the time to sell it.
I think so, because that means, you know.
No,
I
that
think,
is the time. No, that, whether, I,
yeah.
you're right. That's
yeah.
the time to sell it. That's
yeah.
exactly when you sell it, because the cycle is peaking.
That's exactly right. And so that's why I think those are the areas in the market where you want to gravitate towards. What I did, we started by saying you want to have a barbell. I have probably about 70% of my portfolio is cyclical, economically sensitive, reopen things, and about 30% secular growth, because I do believe secular growth is not going away. It may be out of fashion for or out of vogue for a little bit of time.
Right.
But the total addressable markets are just much too strong, and you want to have exposure. You want to have exposure to AI, 5G, cloud, wearables, retail, e-commerce, all of that. So you may get your chance. You may get your opportunity, because those stocks are actually coming down at this point in time while the cyclicals are going higher. So you always get looks, as you know. You have to stay long-term, and I think balance makes the most sense for Fred and Ethel.
And one of the things that I mentioned with Jim Labenthal is that a strong balance sheet and good fundamentals provide you a chair when the music stops on Wall Street. to go into these speculative names that have concepts and not earnings and not balance sheets and lots of debt can make you a lot of money when the momentum is with you and hand you your ass. Yeah. Sorry, Regine, she hates it. We have a listener, and whenever I swear or say anything like that, I get a note from Regine, which is, but they will hand you your ass when a market turns. And I'm always happy with my strong balance sheet to make sure that my portfolio can endure, and I can go back to my clients and say, yes, maybe I didn't get you the last percentage point on earnings, but you were safe the entire time. And when the market goes down, you've always been very happy about that. And I think that caution on Wall Street, particularly as the market's making new highs,
yes,
is never ill-advised, just never. So Stephanie, we can't thank you enough for being with us on another wonderful Farcast. We hope you will come back. She is the chief equity strategist at Hightower Advisors. She is a contributor on CNBC. You see her on Squawk Box. You see her on the Halftime Report. Take it off of mute. And I'm telling you, follow the link.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here. Stay safe.
You are great to be with us. Ladies and gentlemen, you too are great to be with us on the Farcast. We thank you so much for being with us every week. We will be back next week from New Orleans. The Big Easy, laissez les bons temps rouler, let the good times roll. I'm Michael Farr. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for joining us on this week's edition of the Farcast, and thanks to Michael's guest, Jim Labenthal, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest, Stephanie Link. We love hearing from you every week, and we try to respond to all of your notes and suggestions. You can reach us at hjennings@farmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have for one of our guests on past shows or topics you'd like to hear us discuss on future shows. The Farcast comes to you weekly and is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all major podcast platforms. We would like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. The information, statements, comments, views, and opinions expressed and provided in this podcast, including by speakers who are not officers, employees, or agents of Farm Miller in Washington, are not necessarily those of Farm Miller in Washington or any firm any of our guests may represent. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any security, index, fund, manager, or strategy. We strongly recommend you review with a financial professional before you make any investment decision. And if we can be of assistance at Farm Miller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farmmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'll be happy to put any of our listeners in touch with one of our investment professionals for a complimentary review of your portfolio and your investment goals. Take care, stay safe, stay healthy. We'll be back with you next week. Go beyond the headlines each week with the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world.